Did you know that scientists still don't agree on the exact height of Mount Everest or even know what kind of rocks the mountaintop is made of? How is that possible in the 21st century? Well, this hour we're going to talk with the mountain climber Conrad Anker about his upcoming trip to Nepal and some of the geological sleuthing he'll be doing there. And we're going to talk with a physiologist who's tagging along to see what happens to Anker's brain, lungs, and muscles at those towering heights. How does the body acclimate? Plus, Nobel Prize-winning astrophysicist Adam Riess is here to talk about the mysteries of dark energy and the expanding universe, or should we say the multiverse. Are theories about multiple universes science or science fiction? Some answers and your questions after the break, so stay with us. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're broadcasting from the Grosvenor Auditorium at the National Geographic Society in Washington. And later in the hour, we're going to take a look at some of the scientific mysteries of Mount Everest, talk about National Geographic. But first, my next guest shared the Nobel Prize in Physics last year for the unexpected discovery that the universe is not only expanding, but that it's expanding at an accelerating rate, which means everything is zooming away from everything else faster and faster every minute. And that spooky repulsive force has become known as dark energy. Here to shed light on the dark energy, fresh from his visit to Stockholm, is Adam Riess, winner of the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics. He's also a scientist and professor of astronomy at Johns Hopkins University and the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Get over that ceremony yet, or are you still playing it out?
The time change is tough, but we've had a few months to adjust now.
Well, how surprised were you to discover that things were not, the universe wasn't working the way we thought it was working?
Oh, the discovery was shocking, really. I liken it to if you took a pair of keys and threw them up in the air with the purpose of measuring how fast they fall back down to measure how much the earth tugs on your keys, and then they went up instead, you would be very confused. And that's the position my colleagues and I were in 1998 when we saw the universe not slowing down as we expected, but actually speeding up, implying the existence of this very mysterious dark energy.
And where does the dark energy live?
It's here with us in the room. I brought some with me. It's everywhere, really. It's between the galaxies. It is in this room. We believe that everywhere that you have space, empty space, that you cannot avoid having some of this dark energy.
So our concept that we're taught about, that space is empty, is not really empty.
That's right. Your chemistry high school teacher lied to you when they told you...
Not the first time.
that there was such a thing as a vacuum, that you could take space and move every particle out of it. Now, the strange rules of quantum mechanics tell us that that's impossible. That would violate the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And so we believe and we've verified that there are virtual particles, particles that just flip in and out of existence and for very short periods of time borrow energy and create this vacuum energy.
So how do you measure it? How do you know it's there?
Right. Well, what we do is we look at distant exploding stars called supernovae, and we've developed techniques to measure how far away they are and how fast they're moving away from us. So like in the example when I tossed the keys, in order to know that the keys were going up instead of down, you would want to measure how far away they are at different points in time in that trajectory. And so supernovae are the tools, are some of our best tools for making those measurements.
If you'd like to ask Dr. Riess a question, you can come up to the microphones here. He is the superstar in supernovae work and dark energy. If you ever wanted to know something about it, now's the time to do it. What's the difference between dark energy and dark matter?
Yes, that's a good question. So when astronomers talk about something being dark, they mean it doesn't emit light, but also we detect it by its gravity. So in that way, they're similar, but the way they're different is the direction of that gravity. So dark matter attracts things, and dark energy repels things. They're also different in their location. So dark matter, which we believe is made up of small particles, are particles that are drawn to where we see luminous matter. So we see them in galaxies and clusters. Dark energy is everywhere, but since It fills empty space, and most of empty space is between galaxies. Most of the dark energy is actually between galaxies.
So most of the universe then is made of dark energy.
That's right. About 70% of the energy matter budget of the universe is dark energy.
Because there's so much empty space in the universe,
right.
But it's, as you say, it's not empty.
It's not empty.
This is part of the fabric of the emptiness.
That's right.
This expansive pushing out force.
Mm-hmm.
But what is fascinating, most fascinating about this, and the more you talk about it, the more fascinating it gets, is that we didn't always, you just discovered it a few years ago, relatively speaking, and the dark energy didn't kick in as a force.
That's right.
Till relatively recently.
That's right. In fact, it's quite interesting. If we had lived many billions of years ago, we could not have inferred the presence of dark energy, as it only started accelerating the universe a few billion years ago. And as Lawrence Krauss points out in his new book, there will come a point in the future when, if the universe keeps accelerating, galaxies will be so far away from us, most of them, we will not be able to see them anymore. And so we will lose the means to actually infer the universe is accelerating.
So before dark energy sort of kicked in, then we had gravity as a greater force.
That's right.
Pulling the universe back.
That's right, attractive gravity.
And
right.
Then what happened?
And then as the universe got larger, the space between galaxies increased, and ordinary attractive gravity of the dark matter declined, just like you learn in physics class, as 1 over the distance squared. So the matter density is always dropping, but the density in this dark energy is about constant. So if something's falling and something's staying the same, at some point, the thing that's staying the same will win, and that
right.
We are in that winning period.
And as you say, because the universe is expanding, that space has the dark energy in it, sooner or later it got greater than the attractive force of the gravity.
That's right.
Because the space is getting bigger.
That's right.
And why didn't we know about this until a few years ago?
Well, you might say Einstein gave us a clue. Einstein wrestled with a problem back before we even knew the universe was expanding, and he was looking for a way to keep the universe from collapsing. And so he discovered that in his theory of gravity, something like this dark energy, he called it a cosmological constant, could play this role pushing things away. Now, he gave up on it once he learned the universe was expanding, but it was always sort of waiting in the wings as a possibility. So once we saw this, that was the first thing we thought of.
Yeah, and he later said that was the biggest blunder in his life.
That's but, right. That's yeah. right. That, right.
Yeah. Let's go to the audience here. Question here. Yes, sir.
Can I ask two questions since I got squeezed out in the last segment?
Okay, we'll see. Start out with question one.
First question is, do you envision the dark matter, this dark energy, to be able to be beneficial or used by man like gravity? We can use the force of gravity for particular things. Do you ever see getting to be significantly large enough in particular in our area that we can harness it for something, space travel?
Right. I think the greatest likelihood is that by following dark energy, we're likely to develop a deeper understanding of physics. So dark energy is so interesting to us because it lies at the nexus of two incompatible theories in physics. One is quantum theory, which is physics of small objects, and the other is general relativity, which describes gravity on large scales in the universe. And dark energy requires us to use both those theories together, though they're incompatible. So by understanding dark energy, we think we may get to a deeper theory, something people refer to as quantum gravity. And I would say any time we understand physics more deeply, all bets are off. We learn all kinds of interesting things that are very practical in many cases. But I don't see us specifically harnessing, a bag of dark energy or a barrel of dark matter.
Well, not harnessing, but using it in the way that we use gravity to...
You throw up a key, it comes down, it's
right.
going to come down.
Right.
Can we make it so if I throw it up, we know it's going away?
You can send a spaceship around the moon, for instance, and use the gravity of the moon. Can you use the dark
right.
energy?
Right. So the problem then in that scenario is dark energy is weak enough that we never even saw it until we added it up across most of the universe. So we don't see any real measurable effects of dark energy within, let's say, the solar system. And so
right.
it's very difficult to imagine the scenario where we would collect on a large scale of the universe to do something.
So it's so weak, that's why we're still sitting
that's
in our
right.
seat and not being pushed away.
That's
because
right.
it's not strong enough around us to push us apart.
That's right.
Okay, you only get one on that because that was a double question. Yes, go ahead. It was a good question, though.
Are there different theories now about the nature of dark energy and what sort of research is being done to try to distinguish between them or determine it's what it is?
Right, there are. The three leading ideas are similar to what Einstein had described, that vacuum energy is a static property of space itself and that it has to do with space's ability to host virtual particles that appear and disappear. Another possibility is that dark energy is a kind of a field. You could think of the electric field or the magnetic field. This would be a kind of temporary force field that has the property of making the universe expand faster and faster. Another possibility is we have finally broken Einstein's theory of general relativity. He gave it to us in good condition, but we've worked with it so long, and in particular, we've now finally tested it in a realm at a distance that it had never been tested before, and we may have broken it. So we have a sort of whole armada of surveys that are going to be undertaken over the next 10 years to make very precise measurements, probably 100 times more precise than what we've done so far, to measure a couple of properties of dark energy, its strength and its longevity. And we will use those measurements to test them against these different possibilities.
Could it be there are new, whole new areas of physics we don't know about?
Yes.
And new ways of describing the universe we haven't thought of or we haven't figured out yet?
It is. You know, we think the most likely possibility is that we actually discover the nature of dark energy, but it could be embedded in the laws of physics. It could be something deeper that we find and learn about by following dark energy.
And Einstein's theory of gravity, which is a geometrical design, isn't
right.
it? Does dark energy follow the geometry of that, or is it something else?
Well, you can explain it in terms of Einstein's geometry as just another term affecting the curvature or bending of space, but it is also possible that it sits on what we'd say the other side of the equation, not the side that where you collect all the matter and energy, but the side where you describe the physics. And so we're very excited to try to understand on which side of the equation really this dark energy phenomenon lives.
And there are real experiments you can do to figure out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the kinds of experiments we first did in 1998 to see that it was there, we're doing those to a much greater degree with much better statistics with five or six different techniques. People are even starting to test gravity at very small scale lengths, you know, at the sub-millimeter to see if gravity behaves as it should on the smallest scales.
All right. Adam Reitz, we're going to take a short break. He'll stay with us after the break. You can still ask some questions. He is the 2011 Nobel Prize winner in physics. You can ask us questions right here in our audience. You can tweet us at SciFry at S-C-F-R-I. S-C-I-F-R-I. I don't know how to spell it myself. We'll be right back after this break, so stay with us.
Speak Spanish. Ahora, Science Friday, también en español. Encuentra lo mejor de la actualidad científica hispana y del mundo en sciencefriday.com/español.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. We're talking about dark energy with Adam Reitz, the 2011 Nobel Prize winner in physics and the discoverer of this mysterious expansive force. One of the things you always hear about, Adam, when scientists talk about the frontiers of science, and they try to come up with explanations, and one of them is something like, well, maybe it's the multiverse.
Mm.
What is the multiverse, and why are they so eager to throw that in?
Right. So
you don't sound too happy about
well,
it.
Well, I'm not. as an observer, I'll tell you about the challenges of the multiverse. So some of our theories of how the universe began in a period known as inflation, which would have occurred right after the Big Bang, it is possible that there were many universes created, that they sort of bubble out a number far too large to count, maybe 10 to the 500 universes.
Billions of them.
Billions, many billions.
Right.
Some speculate that each of these universes could have different physical conditions, different physical properties. And so while the greatest struggle we have with dark energy, the problem is to try to understand actually, why is it so small? Because
it should be bigger.
Our quantum theory says it should be 120 orders of magnitude bigger.
Wow. So you got two problems. What is it, and why don't we have more of it?
Right. And so the folks who subscribe to the multiverse view say, well, that's not really a problem because maybe dark energy takes many different possible values in all these different universes. Most of those values are too high to allow galaxies to form, planets to form, and us to be here. So those are unlucky universes. But us lucky few in the good universes with the lucky values are here to contemplate our existence.
We're the Goldilocks universe.
That's right. What I don't really love about this is while it is possible that it's true, it doesn't follow the usual scientific method of the tight coupling between ideas and experiment, in that it's very difficult to do an experiment in another universe. We may not actually have access to an experiment like that. And so I think it's been such a fruitful way to continue to come up with theories that are testable and test them. I'm concerned that we become a little disconnected from that process.
So in other words, as scientists say, you can come up with all kinds of theories, but if you can't test out the theory, it's just a nice idea.
Right.
It's not. It may be nice philosophically to think about it, but if you can't come up with a way to test it, it's not a valid scientific.
Right. And I have another objection, I would say, too, to this idea. If I asked a theoretical physicist to derive the distance between the Earth and the sun, they would say, oh, well, you can't do that from first principles. There are lots of planets around lots of stars at lots of separations, and so we are here because there is a good separation between the sun and the Earth, and so we have water here. That is an anthropic argument in the same sense of the multiverse, except in that case, you can actually say, yes, you're right. We have seen lots of planets. We have seen lots of stars. They come at many separations. We have all the prerequisites for a good understanding of why this is anthropically set. I don't feel like we're at the same point yet with this multiverse story, that we know that each universe gets a different set of physical constants and how those are distributed. So I think we have at least some more prerequisites to accomplish.
The fact that we're discovering all these exoplanets now and more, hundreds of them, that we never thought existed, doesn't that lend more credence that we don't need a multiverse to explain why we're here? There are a lot more of us out there.
Right, but the problem is, well, we think that within our universe, the whole universe is stuck with this same dark energy problem. On all these exoplanets are advanced civilizations, and when they reach our level, they say, ugh, we can't understand this dark energy either. In fact, maybe the best solution is we make contact with the more advanced ones at some point, and they tell us the answer.
There you go. That's just like an experimental physicist thinking. Yes, sir.
You mentioned, you brought up Einstein earlier, and of course, E equals mc squared says energy and matter, sort of two sides of the same coin. Is the same true with dark energy and dark matter?
It's true only in so much as they both live along that equality of energy and matter. When we talk about E equals mc squared, we are frequently using it as a conversion in stars when you combine matter in fusion to produce energy. We're not aware, and we don't believe, that the universe makes use of E equals mc squared in the same way because we don't see any process going on like that.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what was it? I kept thinking of the physicist who said, you know, the universe doesn't care if we like to do math.
That's right.
Yes, ma'am. Step up to the mic.
Hi. I had a question about what the relationship is between dark energy and dark matter and string theory. And if there is a relationship, and the other question I had is if all those what we thought were empty spaces are filled with dark energy and dark matter, what does that mean in terms of traveling at the speed of light and time travel and wormholes, that whole
only
issue?
Simple things.
Okay.
Just things I was just sitting and wondering about.
Yeah, on the way home tonight in a car ride.
Let's see. Can I use all of those in a sentence? let me just say that dark energy and dark matter, while they seem like two extra pieces, couldn't we just figure out how to combine them and make them one thing? It's really been a struggle to do that. They look so different in the universe. As I said before, dark matter is clumpy and seems to be made of small particles, and dark energy seems to be smooth and located everywhere. And so therefore, they just don't seem like they're part of the same phenomenon. Rather, I would say, to our great surprise, although we are made of atoms, it turns out most of the universe is not. And although we see each other and communicate by light and sound, it turns out most of the universe does not. It communicates by gravity. And so this is a great surprise to us.
Well, would it communicate by dark energy now?
Well, right. I mean, it's the gravity of the dark energy that we actually see. And so
heavy.
Yes. And so in this case, it's just, you know, we're the, I guess you could say we're the lucky 4% that is just different.
Well, let me see if I understand. You said it's the gravity of the dark energy. Do you mean that literally?
Yeah.
The gravity?
Right. So
the repulsiveness, the repulsive.
That's right. So just to give you an analogy.
Gravity, we think of pulling together.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you had a wind tunnel.
Right.
You would not be able to see the wind, but you could release a little smoke in the wind tunnel, and then you could track it. And so these supernovae ride around in the dark energy, and we see the gravity as it affects the supernovae and the universe, although we cannot literally see the dark energy. We cannot literally see that stuff.
And she asked about string theory. Can that explain any of this stuff?
So string theory has not predicted or explained very much to date, although...
Another skeptic.
Yeah, but, well, I'm an observer, so I sort of look at what is it predicting, what can I look at. But string theory has predicted these 10 to the 500 universes. And so
the multiverse.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so perhaps one day that will be a very profound conclusion, but I think it's premature.
Yeah. Can I see if we get the last question here? Yeah, well, and then we'll go to here.
My question was about dark matter. If we thought we had any testable theories or envisioned any experiments where we may be able to sort of figure out what the nature of this dark matter is.
We're getting very close, actually. There are direct detection experiments where they actually try to build detectors. It's very difficult to detect dark matter because it's made out of a particle that we believe does not interact. It doesn't have charge, and so it doesn't interact in the usual way. It's flitting through all of us. But you could produce detectors made out of very dense materials and locate them in mines below the surface of the Earth, where the surface of the Earth acts to filter out the ordinary background particles. And a number of experiments have started to find just a few of these dark matter particles, so few that we're still not sure. It's going to be another year or two whether we know they were just unlucky, that they had some errors, or whether they're actually there. But if it's not this year, it'll be in a couple.
How do you know it's not a neutrino flying through?
Well, that's what they're very good at, is trying to figure out. They know the mass scale of neutrinos. That's very different, and so it creates different products. Also, the Large Hadron Collider, which is working in CERN, is expected to produce dark matter particles as part of the collisions. And so I think we're probably within, hopefully, just a few years of actually directly measuring and seeing dark matter.
Physics, it's always just a few years.
Just a few years? Yeah. That's what we say to the funding agency.
Yes. Go ahead.
So in the terms of the multiverse, if our universe is expanding, wouldn't it eventually collide with others and expand into other universes?
That's a really good question. It is the... one way, maybe the only way, we could actually discover that this multiverse story is true is if there are collisions between what they call the brains, and this is B-R-A-N-E, like a membrane, but the surfaces of the different universes. And if they collide, it would look like a giant explosion. So we could be sitting here one day, and there would be a giant explosion coming from a dimension that we don't see. People look for a relic of this in the radiation left over from the Big Bang, and nobody has really seen that yet. And so it's a very long shot, but that's the only chance we think we would have.
It's a long shot. Last question here. Yes, he's back.
In string theory, dark energy and dark matter, they both... string theory says that everything is both a particle and a wave, right? So how would dark energy and dark matter both act as particles and waves? Or is this one of the ways that string theory and this dark energy stuff just don't go together?
Right.
I think he's on your side on this.
I think so. That's a good question. So actually, it's not just string theory that says that objects act like particles and waves. In actually quantum theory, and that's a very mainline theory of physics, all particles act as particles and waves. And so it is true that dark matter and dark energy would have this aspect. But we are mostly interested at this point in the gravity of dark energy and dark matter. So we don't often get to see interactions, like collisions between dark matter particles that would actually illustrate the particle and wave nature.
Adam Riess, everybody, thank you very much for taking time to be with us. Winner of the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics, also a scientist and professor of astronomy at Johns Hopkins University and the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. The world's tallest peak. It's so iconic. It's so classic. You'd think we'd have learned everything there is to know about it by now. But you'd be wrong. Scientists still can't even agree on the exact height of the mountain. And what's more, they're not even sure what kind of rocks the mountaintop is made of. But my next guest is going to help answer these geological questions when he heads for the summit of Everest. And as he climbs, his heart and his lungs and his muscles are going to be monitored to see how they respond to the thinning air. Also, joining me now to talk about that is Conrad Anker. He is a mountaineer and National Geographic grantee, also a North Face climber and athlete team captain based in Bozeman, Montana. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
When are you going up there on the mountain?
Well, we leave Sunday, so it's 40
what time hours. Is it?
And
how do you prepare for a trip like this?
A trip like this, there's the physical component, and then there's the logistics component. So I try to stay in shape. That's an ongoing process, exercising. And then the logistics is permits from the government of Nepal and then the funding for it. So to bring both of those together with a strong team, and we're set to go.
And this is not your first time, right?
This will be my third Everest expedition.
And people refer to the zone at the top of the mountain as the death zone. That's pretty descriptive about what's the danger up there?
The death zone is above 8,000 meters, which is roughly 26,000 feet and change. And it's at that point the body really starts deteriorating very rapidly. We have about a third of the amount of oxygen that we would have here at close to sea level. And we just oxygen is very essential for life. After 4 minutes without oxygen, we have irreparable brain damage. So going without oxygen at this time takes either a serious amount of training, a good physiological adaptation, or supplemental oxygen.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Conrad Anker. Yet there's so many people who want to just go up there. I mean, isn't there sort of an eco tour taking people up all the time, and they're not prepared, and they get into trouble and stuff like that?
The two most popular routes, one on the north side from Tibet and the other one on the south side from Nepal, they're guided. There's people that go up there, and they're sort of people that have ambition. There's the hardcore climber that saves up, and then there's sort of the trophy hunter, someone that has done well in business and has the money, has $70,000 to get a ride up Mount Everest, and they want the trophy on the wall.
In 1999, you discovered the body of the long-lost British mountaineer George Mallory on Everest. How did you come across that?
Our expedition was set out specifically to look for this missing English climber, and he was discovered in 1975 by a Chinese climber. He shared that with a Japanese climber in 1980, so we knew by history that he had disappeared, and our expedition set out to look for him, and it was just by chance. I was traversing at an elevation of about 8,300 meters, and I came across a frozen and well-preserved body of a climber that had perished 75 years before we were there.
Are there lots of bodies lying in the road there?
Well, there are people always, two things. Everyone thinks it's a rubbish heap up there and there's bodies everywhere. And on both counts, it's not quite the case. People clean up the garbage and then bodies are removed off the mountain. But you do have to make peace with death if you're going to go up there, because we're living on a thread.
So as you go higher and higher, what happens? Does sort of time slow down for you? You have to move slower and your body functions slower, or what?
Yes, exactly. We have less oxygen. Our body goes into we're shunting blood away from our extremities to our core, and then from next step is we take it away from our central processing unit, which is our brain, and then we put it into our core. So unless you're physiologically able to adapt for that with good external circulation, distal circulation, and with supplemental oxygen, the clock is ticking as you're going higher.
And on this trip, though, you're going to be monitored to see what's happening.
That's correct. We have a team coming out from the Mayo Clinic, and I was out there 10 days ago, and they did a really in-depth test.
And so we're
a series of tests.
And it's, well, they are preliminary studies to see what happens as you go up there higher. And that's what we're going to talk about in the next segment. bring these, some of the members of this team up there. How experienced are they in going up the mountain?
Our team is an experienced climber, and of everyone on our team, I'm the only one that has summited Everest. So the other eight climbers were nine together, two on the West Ridge and seven on the Southeast Ridge. I'm the only one that has summited, which is fair as a team leader, but that sense of newness and that approaching it as they've never seen it before is a great part of the story and a chance for them to engage in science.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in about a minute. But just anecdotally, do you see any evidence of global warming?
Oh, it is tremendous. How do mountains hear? It's with mountaineers. It's a silly little joke. But what we're seeing up there is scary and frightening. Routes that were climbed in the 1970s have melted away. The high-altitude cryosphere, which is the ice that holds these mountains together, is receding at an alarming rate. And we see it as climbers all over the place. And it's something that it's our duty as climbers to come back and share this knowledge because it's happening for real. And if you play golf and you're in Kansas, it's in an artificial environment. But where we are, high-altitude and high-latitude areas are being affected by climate.
Well, you've just shared it with a lot of people. We're going to take a break and come back and talk more with Conrad Anker and the members of his team. And you can step up to the microphone if you want to know what it's like to climb Mount Everest. Man, maybe you want to go up there sometimes. We'll talk to you later, right after this break. Stay with us. Ira here with a quick reminder to upgrade your iPhone and iPad app. We're adding all kinds of new features. We're making the app easier and more enjoyable to use. Flora's videos look just gorgeous on the iPad. You've made suggestions, we've listened to them, and over the coming days, please check iTunes and search under the keywords Science Friday. A newer, better app is waiting for you to download on iTunes. And we haven't forgotten you Android users. The updated Android app will be right behind. Now back to the show. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about climbing Mount Everest with Conrad Anker. He is a mountaineer and National Geographic grantee. He's also a North Face climber and athlete team captain based in Bozeman, Montana. And as Conrad climbs up, up and away, his bodily functions are going to be monitored to see how they react to those stresses by Brian Taylor, a research fellow in the Division of Cardiovascular Diseases at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He joins us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Taylor.
Thank you.
Looking forward to the climb?
I am. Very excited. Right. Very excited.
That's good. David Lagesson is a professor of structural geology at Montana State University in Bozeman, and he is going up Everest with Conrad all the way to the summit to collect some rocks at the top and to remeasure the height of the peak. He's also a National Geo grantee. He joins us from Bozeman. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, sir.
How do you collect rocks at the top when there's no air to breathe and you have a hammer and have to hammer away at something? You ready for that?
Very slowly. it'll be interesting. It's not like doing field work here in Montana where there's plenty of air to breathe.
Yeah. Dr. Lagesson, why don't we know what the top of the mountain is made of? Why is it such a mystery?
Well, good question. We do in a general sense, for sure. It's been known for many years that there's limestone up there and that it's fairly old limestone. But the reality is just a few samples have really come back from the summit of Mount Everest over the years. And, of course, the reason for that is the incredible elevation. It's extreme height.
Yeah, and so it's hard to work up there and collect the rocks, bring them back?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Exactly right. There's a lot more known about the lower elevations around Mount Everest than the upper elevations, for sure.
Mm. Now, Brian Taylor, you're going to Nepal to study how the high altitude affects Conrad and the other climbers. How are they going to be wired and measured and taken readings up?
So we have several different measures that we're going to look at with Conrad and his team. On the climb on the way up, both towards base camp and then to the peak, they will wear remote monitors that will measure their energy expenditure mostly through accelerometry. Once myself and our team from the Mayo Clinic get to base camp, we'll be doing studies that look at changes in the size of their lungs and how they're able to function their lungs, how well they transfer gas from the lungs to their blood to stay oxygenated, The development of fluid on their lung, which is very common at high altitude, disruptions in their sleep, changes in how their brain stimulates the different kind of organs of the body, etc., as we're there at base camp.
Has this ever been done before?
Studies of this type are common. You know, to be fair, that this type of research has been ongoing for about 50 years or so. Our lab itself has a history over the last 15 to 20 years of doing such research. What we do is we're providing a small increment in terms of what we already know. Mm. Perhaps a new question. Our primary interest is how disruption in sleep pattern altitude can help us explain some of the common occurrences, the common negative occurrences with altitude. As I said, specifically the buildup of fluid on the lung and muscle wasting or a loss of body mass at altitude.
Conrad, what effects do you notice on your body? Give us an idea. Do you get hallucinations, thirsty? What does it feel like?
Being thirsty is one of the primary downfalls of it. So you have to hyperhydrate. You're urinating more frequently. People have wild dreams, it's reported, at altitude. But I enjoy going to altitude, and I acclimatize well. So I get supercharged, and it's my vacation, so I'm happy up there.
You know, I read the book Into Thin Air. It didn't sound like much of a vacation in that book. But
yeah, but suffering for me is fun. So this is like the e-ticket ride on in Disneyland.
It is. You know, when athletes do a marathon, I'm closest I can compare it to, the night or two before, they bulk up with a lot of carbs and things. Do you have to do that kind of storage of those kinds of things that your body needs?
Yes, exactly. And it's not just a night. So from Thanksgiving on, it's been open season on calories. So when I was at the Mayo Clinic, I was tested, and my body fat came in around 18-19%. So I've been eating walnuts, almonds, and olive oil, healthy fats, and I've put on my insurance roll right around my waist. And
yeah, you look so fat.
It's there.
Yeah, I'm sure, right? If you have a question, you step up to the microphone and ask a question. Yes, ma'am.
You were starting to get to my question. I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro a lot of years ago, and most of us were in our 20s, and we're real healthy and fit, but not athletes. And at least half the group couldn't make it. And I wondered if there's a way to predict who can go up to low oxygen, high, you know, there's no oxygen, you can't breathe.
Yeah, part of it is genetic, and part of this is what Brian Taylor and the team at the Mayo Clinic are studying, is what are the markers that differentiate some people from doing well and other people not doing well. The indigenous people to Nepal, the Sherpa, do very well at altitude, and what is different from them and from other people. And a lot of these same markers are similar to cardiovascular disease. So we're not just going up there to study it because it's fun and it's an exotic place to go do it, but what we learn from being at altitude, being on Everest, can help people with cardiovascular disease, and especially with the monitoring devices, if they're robust enough to take to the summit of Everest and record 1 week's or a month's worth of information at one time and then bring it back, these same devices, we can then use them with citizens around the nation on a day-to-day basis.
Brian Taylor, what is different about Sherpa blood, or why they're so easy? They make it look so effortless.
That's a very good question. Perhaps not as well understood as what we'd like, and certainly from different high-altitude areas around the world, and different Sherpas or porters from that area seem to be slightly different. But certainly some of the main differences would be a higher hematocrit or red blood cell level, which helps carry or maintain the oxygen levels on the blood, which is obviously very key. One of the other things that we see is fairly common is the surface area of the lungs, or the ability to, as I said earlier, move gas that we breathe in from the lungs to the blood to, again, maintain adequate oxygenation is improved in these people. So, but as Conrad said, it's very much multifaceted. There's definitely a genetic component. I know if we could figure it out, then that'd be great.
Yeah. David Longison, we were mentioning before about the kinds of rocks that are at the tippy top of Mount Everest. A lot of people don't realize that Mount Everest was once the bottom of the ocean. Is that correct?
That's right. That's absolutely correct.
How the heck did it get all the way up there, the bottom of the ocean?
Yeah, I think that's one of the amazing things about some of the world's great peaks, and Mount Everest in particular, is you're looking at a a magnificent monument to the power of plate tectonics. To think that the sea floor of the Tethys Ocean 470 million years ago could have been carried northward and eventually caught up in this collisional zone with India and Eurasia, and then eventually uplifted to form Mount Everest, I just think is an amazing story about how dynamic this planet is and how alive these mountains really are.
So you had these two plates that smash into each other right at the border of India there and push up the mountain higher and higher?
Yes, classic example of a plate boundary collision zone between two continental land masses.
Could you find fossils that showed when it was at the bottom of the ocean on the top there?
Yeah, those limestones at the summit, there are fossils reported from those carbonate rocks, and they're mostly little tiny marine invertebrate animals, little seashells essentially. And using high-powered microscopes and thin sections of the rock, we can identify what those animals are.
Hmm. I know that, Conrad, this is we're fascinated by this, and that's one part of your mission is an educational part to let everybody else know about this.
That's correct. We're working with National Science Foundation and EBSCOR and Montana State University to create a curriculum for fifth graders. And so there's 8 weeks of class study that will be open to every student across the planet through the web. You can track our journey along as we climb the mountain. It's over a period of 10 weeks. And specifically, there's 8 classroom curriculum that are designed to get students excited about science, to increase their science literacy, and to eventually get more scientists and get more people excited about science and more people listening to your show. So we want this.
We'd like to get more people listening, but we're just as happy to have kids, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of kids listening. And how do they participate? Is there a website?
There's a website, montana.edu, and check in there. And there's curriculum that's available. And then there's 20 classrooms in the state of Montana that we selected, and they have a teacher's kit. And so they have rock hammers, a sampling of rock from limestone to granite. They have a miniature time-lapse camera, a pulse oximeter. So a lot of the things that we're looking at, both from Earth Sciences and the Mayo Clinic health performance side, are going to be there. And these 10-year-olds, which is about the age of a fifth grader, they're going to be engaged in science.
One of these days there's going to be a Wi-Fi section on top of Mount Everest so people can see what's going on.
It's pretty close to that. And as back in the day, it used to be you would go on an expedition, you'd come back, and you would talk about it. And then there was slideshows, and then there was movies. And now we have the Internet, and it's Everest season. So people tune in to the websites. They follow the expeditions. And we'll be reporting through a variety of channels about the geology, the human performance, what it's like to be there, follow the adventure along. And it's a great way for people to understand climbing, because it's not something that shows up like Monday Night Football. It's kind of this, it's a story that goes over a period of time.
Yeah, it's great. Yes, question in the audience.
Yes, hi. There's a number of physiologic changes that were mentioned earlier that a human body experiences as it goes to altitude. I'm originally from Colorado, and I know when I go home, even just 8,000 feet, it takes me a couple of days to acclimate. I was wondering if you could remark on how long those physiologic changes actually endure for, and if any of them endure for long term.
I think we get back. We still have a higher blood cell, red blood cell count for 2 weeks before it diminishes there. So
2 weeks.
Yeah, Dr. Taylor, do you have any input on that?
Yeah, that's about right. Again, it's variable within a certain individual or subject, but a red blood cell count will remain elevated for about 2 weeks.
So do you become Superman for 2 weeks, or can you notice the difference back on the ground, sea level?
From a sports performance point of view, it's actually relatively well done that most athletes will actually go and do a high altitude training camp before a major competition, say the Olympics. The idea being that they come back and perform at a time when their ability to carry and utilize oxygen in their blood is actually increased. Again, you know, there's a lot of discrepancies in that literature, but it's certainly anecdotally found. In terms of other kind of aspects, we hope to monitor the climbers and ourselves as we come back for that period, that first tour, 2 to 3 weeks, to see if there are any other physiological changes that persist, specifically perhaps the potential changes in lung fluid, etc.
Yeah. This is Science Friday from NPR.
I'm Ira Plato at Grosvenor Auditorium at National Geographic Society here in New York, talking about some geographic climbers that are going to go up Mount Everest. David Loggison, why do you need to remeasure the altitude? I mean, how do we not know how high Mount Everest is?
Well, we essentially do. I mean, the first elevation was done back in 1856, and it's been resurveyed, you know, three or four times since then. So we have it pretty well identified in terms of certainly in the ballpark. But why redo it? There's a couple of reasons. Number one, certainly it's the world's tallest mountain. It's utterly iconic on this planet. People want to know what its elevation is. And I think it behooves us as we get new technology and better instruments to sort of keep after the task, do the best that we can to identify the height of the planet's largest mountain.
Yeah, and how will you
do this? Just for that.
Do you put an instrument, a special instrument up there, or how is it a satellite measurement, or what is it?
Yeah, we'll be using GPS instruments. These are instruments provided by Trimble, and we'll have two receivers on the summit and then an instrument down at base camp for doing what's called differential corrections after we bring the instruments back down. Mm-hmm. And so it's basically GPS-based.
Yeah. So you're going to be leaving them up there? Or are you taking them?
I don't think Trimble would like that. Well, they're pretty expensive. Yeah. We'll have to bring them back down, and at base camp, we download the data onto computers and do some post-processing. And I'll be bringing along a graduate student.
I think we lost our connection. You there? We lost our question. He's going to bring a graduate student to carry it, I'll bet you.
Travis Courthouse. So, yeah.
Yeah?
And Travis will be helping us out, and this will be good because it'll give us a chance to understand how fast Mount Everest is growing. So
It's still growing.
It is. And imagine the speed the Indian subcontinent moving into Eurasian landmass is about as fast as your fingernails grow. And geologically speaking, that's really fast.
Light speed.
Yeah, it's getting crushed up. But Everest itself is being pushed south like squeezed out of a tube of toothpaste and then being compounded by erosional effects of glaciers. So it's great science. It's a great way to engage young people in the basic principles of science.
And you've gotten the whole ball of wax here. You have the geology. You have the medical aspect of it. You have the rock climbing part of it. You have the physical health and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, we're excited.
Well, let me see if I get one last quick question in here quickly before we go.
As an amateur climber, I know how good I feel after just a couple of pitches. Can you just describe what it's like to stand at the top of the world?
Standing on top of Everest is very humbling. You're there and it's good weather. Hopefully you're lucky you're there and you're feeling miserable. The joy isn't until you get back down and you're at base camp and you're with your friends and everything like that. But anything that you put effort into and that sense of reward for working hard, if that's something that is meaningful to you, climbing Everest is where it's at.
All right. I want to thank you all for taking time to be with us today. And when are you beginning? When do you leave for us?
We leave for Kathmandu on the 18th. So we arrive Kathmandu on the 20th, and we have three or four days getting our permits for our geology collection work and elevation. And then we head into the mountains. We should be at base camp around the 5th of May, or probably 5th of April. We acclimatize through the month of April, moving higher on the mountain. And anywhere from the first week of May to the first of June is our summit window.
Okay, we'll be watching for you and watching on the website.
And we'll be, if we can, we'll tune into Science Friday from
Base Camp. Oh, give us a call. Wouldn't that be something? We've been from Antarctica. Thank you all for being with us today. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Amisha Serene Anand. Luis Quevedo is our Spanish language producer. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Neil Rausch is our technical director. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.